Blog Talk Radio.
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world.
Yesterday was the 32nd anniversary of the passing of Imagine singer and former Beatle, John Lennon. Good Sunday afternoon. It's 12 p.m. Eastern Time in the U.S., and that means it's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser. I'm your host, Steve Laser, and I thank you for deciding to spend a part of your afternoon with me. Before I get into our program for today, I just want to make you all aware of a change in the time and frequency of the show. Going forward for now, Making Sense will air once a week on Sunday evenings at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. At that time, we will recap the news of the week, of course, with my analysis on what each of the events means. We'll take a look at forward at what the next week will bring, and of course, each show will cover my Hall of Fame and shame for those politicians and pundits who are noteworthy for either making a lot of sense or a lot of nonsense. We have a great show for you today. Topics we will cover include Charlie Crist, now that he has become a Democrat. Should Democrats vote for him for governor of Florida if he chooses to run? We're going to talk about the Middle East and get an update on the goings-on in Syria and Egypt. And we're going to look at whether DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, is headed for overturn in the U.S. Supreme Court. So let's get started with whether DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, is history. It was announced that this session, the Supreme Court will take up no less than two cases regarding gay marriage. Each of these will decide whether, in the court's estimation, equal protection applies to gay marriage and gay rights, effectively deciding whether government can discriminate against the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered, or LGBT, community. The cases are United States v. Windsor and Hollingsworth v. Perry. A quick background on these two cases. First, United States v. Windsor, as described by Wikipedia. In 2007, Edith Windsor and Taya Spire, residents of New York, married in Toronto, Ontario, after 40 years of romantic partnership. Now, Spire died in 2009, and that's what touched off the controversy in this situation, at which time that she died, that New York legally recognized same-sex marriages performed in other jurisdictions. After her death, Windsor, her partner, was required to pay more than $363,000 in federal estate taxes on her inheritance. Now, if federal law had accorded their marriage the same status as heterosexual marriages recognized by their state, she would not have paid any federal taxes. Besides Windsor, other plaintiffs in the case are federal workers who are not allowed to add their spouses to health care plans and other benefits. At issue, of course, is DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. If federal law accorded their marriage the same status as different sex marriages, obviously Windsor would have paid no taxes, no federal taxes. So the court is going to examine specifically whether Section 3 of DOMA violates the 5th and 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clauses. Section 3 of DOMA says that there is a federal policy of non-recognition of same-sex marriages for all federal purposes, including insurance benefits for government employees, Social Security survivors benefits, immigration, and the filing of joint tax returns. Now, Section 3 of DOMA has been found unconstitutional in 8 federal courts, including the First and Second Circuit Court of Appeals, on issues ranging from bankruptcy, public employee benefits, estate taxes, and immigration. As of the start of the 2012 Supreme Court session, 5 of those cases were awaiting a response for review in the U.S. Supreme Court. The Obama administration, for its part, announced in 2011 that it had determined that Section 3 of DOMA was unconstitutional, and though it would continue to enforce the law, it would no longer defend it in court. Now, in response to that proclamation by the administration, the Republican leadership of the House of Representatives instructed the House General Counsel to defend the law in place of the Department of Justice. Now, regarding Hollingsworth v. Perry, it's a Prop 8 case and requires a little bit more background. Wikipedia on Hollingsworth v. Perry states, in May 2008, the Supreme Court of California held that state statutes limiting marriage to opposite-sex applicants violated the California Constitution. The following month, same-sex couples were able to get married in California. But in November 2008, California's electorate adopted Proposition 8, which was a constitutional amendment that restored the opposite-sex limitation on marriage. Following the adoption of Prop 8, several lawsuits were filed in California that challenged the validity of the amendment under various state constitutional provisions, and ultimately Proposition 8 was overturned by the California Supreme Court. That decision is being appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court by proponents of Proposition 8. Now, notice I said proponents of Proposition 8. An interesting point about Hollingsworth is that ordinarily arguing in favor of a state amendment or law would be done by the state governor, state government, either the attorney general of that state or the governor. Both of those offices refused to defend Prop 8. So arguing in its favor instead is a loose coalition of anti-gay marriage groups. So the first thing that the U.S. Supreme Court wants to do is address the standing of those groups to argue in favor of Prop 8. That alone is very much in doubt. And the Supreme Court could rule right off that those groups do not have the standing to argue that point, which would result in California Supreme Court's ruling overturning Proposition 8 being upheld. And frankly, that would allow the U.S. Supreme Court to avoid dealing with the issues of gay marriage in that case. A lot of the LGBT community is excited about these cases coming before the court. I'm excited about it, but I'm also cautiously optimistic, knowing that at least one member of the court is on record in the past as saying there is no constitutional protection for gay marriage. I'm, of course, talking about Justice Antonin Scalia, and that was this past October, where he indicated that to vote against anything regarding gay rights was, in his words, a no-brainer. In fact, as I look at the votes, assuming they're both decided on the civil rights issues and not on more esoteric issues like standing, they seem to be shaping up as a 5-4 decision. The yes votes to strike down prohibitions on gay marriage are Justices Stephen Breyer, Ruth Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan. That's four, right? But I think there are almost also certainly four votes to uphold it, and that's Chief Justice John Roberts, Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, and, of course, our friend Justice Scalia. The pivotal vote is probably going to be, as it is on many matters, Justice Anthony Kennedy. When you look at Justice Kennedy's past rulings like Romer v. Evans and Lawrence v. Texas, he has sided with the Ginsburg wing of the justices on gay rights issues almost every time. And that looks to be some real cause for optimism. However, Justice Kennedy has also said certain things that lead me to add caution to my optimism. In his discussion of the Lawrence v. Texas issue, he described how that ruling overturned the Browers v. Hardwick decision that upheld anti-gay sodomy laws in the states. And in that discussion, he said the following.
Now, in today's opinion, we discussed some of the cases decided before Bowers. These precedents, including Griswold versus Connecticut, Eisenstadt versus Baird, Roe versus Wade, and Kerry versus Population Services, all limited the government's authority to enter the most private aspect of the lives of individuals. The holding of Bowers is inconsistent with the teaching of these cases. Two principal cases decided after Bowers cast its holding into even further doubt. These are Planned Parenthood versus Casey and Romer versus Evans. Romer versus Evans was a case decided under the Equal Protection Clause. There may be a tenable argument that the guarantee of equal protection renders the Texas statute unconstitutional, but it is our view that the instant case requires us to address whether Bowers itself has continuing validity. We conclude the rationale of Bowers does not withstand careful analysis. Bowers was not correct when it was decided, and it is not correct today. It ought not to remain binding precedent. Bowers versus Hardwick should be, and now is, overruled. The present case does not involve minors. It does not involve persons who might be injured or coerced or who are situated in relationships where consent might not easily be refused. It does not involve public conduct or prostitution. It does not involve whether the government must give formal recognition to any relationship that homosexual persons seek to enter. The case does involve two adults who, with full and mutual consent from each other, engage in sexual practices common to a homosexual lifestyle. The petitioners are entitled to respect for their private lives. The state cannot demean their existence or control their destiny by making their private sexual conduct a crime. Their right to liberty, under the Due Process Clause, gives them the full right to engage in their conduct without intervention of the government. It is the promise of the Constitution that there is a realm of personal liberty which the government may not enter.
Now, notice, I have to say that Justice Kennedy said a lot of great things there, but notice also the specific reference by Kennedy to that ruling not affecting whether any government should, quote, give formal recognition to any relationship that homosexual persons seek to enter. That concerns me. I don't know if he's just being accurate as to the decision limitations of Lawrence, or he is expressing a personal unwillingness to rule in favor of same-sex marriage. If I have to make a call right now, I would say that the court will rule that the private coalition of groups fighting in favor of Proposition 8 in Hollingsworth v. Perry would be ruled to not have the standing, and Proposition 8 will go down as a result. I would also guess that in United States v. Windsor, that Kennedy will rule with the court liberals and overturn at least Section 3 of DOMA, if not decide more broadly that attempts to legislate against gay rights and gay marriage violate equal protection in general. I'm going to guess that Justice Kennedy is going to understand that the groundswell of support for gay marriage around the country means that the people believe that gay marriage is a civil rights issue. It's an equal protection issue. And that to rule against it and suggest that the constitutional protections on equality do not cover it is to deny an obvious truth that rights that are currently guaranteed for one group of Americans are arbitrarily being denied to another group. Justice Kennedy, it's time to strike down DOMA and to go further and use its opportunity once and for all right several historic wrongs. Now it's time for an update on the Middle East. Regarding Syria, there were scattered reports earlier this week that Syria's Bashar Assad was readying that country's stockpile of chemical weapons for use against his own people, or at least the rebels. There's specific talk that sarin gas was going to be used against the rebels. Sarin is an extremely potent nerve agent, and death from a lethal dose usually occurs in under a minute without immediate treatment. Speaking of lethal dose, sarin is described as 500 times more potent than cyanide, and thus the amount required to be lethal is very small. It's easily absorbed through the skin or inhaled. Now, after those reports, Secretary of State Clinton had this to say.
Our concerns are that an increasingly desperate Assad regime might turn to chemical weapons or might lose control of them to one of the many groups that are now operating within Syria. And so as part of the absolute unity that we all have on this issue, we have sent an unmistakable message that this would cross a red line and those responsible would be held to account.
Now, for its part, the Syrian government says it will absolutely not use this weapon against the rebels. And as the week progressed, more sources and news agencies were reporting that the government may just be moving the weapons around in order to keep them out of the hands of the rebels, and they were not planning to use them against its own people. Now, of course, any assertion by the U.S. that a Middle Eastern country has or might use chemical weapons brings up some uncomfortable memories.
The danger to our country is grave. The danger to our country is growing. The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons. The Iraqi regime is building the facilities necessary to make more biological and chemical weapons. And according to the British government, the Iraqi regime could launch a biological or chemical attack in as little as 45 minutes after the order were given. The regime has long-standing and continuing ties to terrorist organizations. And there are Al-Qaeda terrorists inside Iraq. The regime is seeking a nuclear bomb. And with fissile material, could build one within a year.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Weapons of mass death.
The intelligence that we were operating off was correct.
The quality of our intelligence operation, I think we're better than anybody else.
We gathered a lot of intelligence. That intelligence was good, sound intelligence.
But we now know that Saddam has resumed his efforts to acquire nuclear weapons. Among other sources, we've gotten this from first-hand testimony from defectors, including Saddam's own son-in-law.
Delay in decision and inaction could lead to a massive and sudden horror.
It simply makes no sense to wait any longer.
Take action before it's too late.
We will not wait.
As President Bush has said, time is not on our side.
I still thought that 3.5 months for new inspections was a rather short time before cooling day. And especially when we now see that they say, the U.S. government is saying that, look, you have to have a bit of patience. You know, these things take time.
If someone is waiting for a so-called smoking gun, it's certain that we will have waited too long.
We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Just unbelievable when you think back about that. And, of course, no WMD were found after that. There are literally hours and hours of Bush administration lies regarding Iraqi weapons of mass destruction that I could play. Needless to say, we in the U.S. have a bit of a credibility issue regarding reports of weapons of mass destruction. We have George W. Bush and the cast of clowns in his administration to thank for that. I personally do not think that Syria is planning on using chemical weapons on the rebels or any other group of its own people, but it is a scary thought and brings up uncomfortable questions. If Assad does use chemical weapons against his own people, should the rest of the world stand by and watch? The American people are extremely tired of war and wary of new military involvements, but if Assad uses sarin gas against his people, which would kill hundreds or thousands, the pressure to intervene would be immense. Well, let's all hope it doesn't come to that, and if it does, that some other country or coalition of countries intervenes and the U.S. stays out of it. Regarding Egypt, Egypt's President Morsi, who a month ago granted himself nearly dictatorial powers, is now backing down on his power grab, but pressing his demand for a December 15th referendum on a new Egyptian constitution. An independent panel in Egypt is recommending that the referendum go forward. And actually, let me backtrack on that. Late-breaking news from Egypt is that Morsi has given in on the referendum question. He's given in on that as well, so it will be postponed for now. The question, though, is, was too much damage done by President Morsi to himself and to his reputation to be salvaged? I think he's done too much damage. Evidence for this is that protesters continue to occupy Tahrir Square in Egypt. Some are suggesting a general strike until Morsi steps down. Meanwhile, Egypt's powerful military has entered the fray, demanding both sides meet and threatening to take action to prevent a further escalation of the issue, and that's an extremely ominous sign. Morsi has apparently been meeting this weekend with opposition leaders in his home to try to negotiate a way out of the crisis. Right now, if I had to bet, I would say that the situation is going to end with Morsi stepping down. He should never have tried to assert dictatorial powers for himself, and he was way too slow in realizing the mistake that he made. I think the protesters are probably going to be at him until he relents and steps down, and that's going to create another power vacuum in Egypt, and there's always a risk that the military there will step into that. So we are entering another period of extreme uncertainty with that country and probably with the region in general between Egypt and Syria. Moving on, Charlie Crist is now a Democrat. Should Florida Democrats back him for governor? Well, some background on this. Charlie Crist was the former Republican of governor before the current embarrassment known as Rick Scott. Crist decided not to run for re-election, but instead ran for the U.S. Senate. Now, Tea Parties were upset at Crist because at one televised moment, he was seen hugging President Obama, and he also suggested that the stimulus enacted by Obama was a good idea. The Tea Party wing of the Republican Party was so mad at him that they made it their mission to deny him the Republican nomination for the Florida Senate seat. And Crist eventually lost the nomination to Marco Rubio by around 20 points. Undaunted, Crist switched party affiliation to independent and continued his run for the Senate seat as an independent. Many Democrats in Florida suggested at the time that Crist had a better chance than the Democratic nominee of defeating the extreme far-right Rubio. And Crist won the support of many Democrats. Crist ultimately lost the election, however, to Rubio by 49% to 30%, with the Democratic nominee garnering 20%. This past Thursday, Crist made the switch to the Democratic Party official. Now, regarding Crist, there's a lot of controversy about him right now in Democratic circles. I can say that I've met him a number of times when I was living in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is where Crist and his father live. I know a number of folks who have known Crist for over 25 years. He was never a real Republican, in my opinion, at least not how today's Republicans seem to define themselves and act. At worst, he was an Eisenhower Republican, which is probably the equivalent of today's moderate to conservative Democrat. While in office as Florida's governor, Crist took a number of moderate positions, including being very supportive of Florida's teachers. And as mentioned, he supported President Obama's stimulus. I'm certainly willing to consider accepting Crist. Now, in my opinion, to be accepted as a Democrat, the one thing that Crist does need to do is he must recant his earlier positions opposing gay rights and gay marriage. If he does that, I think he should be welcomed with open arms. Crist would be the odds-on favorite to beat Rick Scott and once again become the governor of Florida, this time as a Democrat. In making the switch, Mr. Crist, who campaigned for Barack Obama in the 2012 election, said, quote, "I've had friends my whole life tell me I'm a Democrat, but didn't know it," end quote. Now, I could tell those of you listening to my show that that's true, because I know some of the folks who've said that to him. Crist is much too nice of a guy to have ever been a real Republican politician. On now, finally, to our Hall of Fame and shame for those politicians who made particularly good sense or particularly bad nonsense in the past week. Sadly, there are no entries for the Hall of Fame for making sense this week. I don't know what kind of a commentary exactly that is on politics, but that it is what it is. All of the action was in the Hall of Shame for talking nonsense. Third worst in the Nonsense Hall of Shame this week was defeated Florida Congressman, the nutty teabagger favorite, Republican Alan West, who compared himself to Abraham Lincoln, saying that Lincoln also served just one term in Congress. Alan West is also the guy who said that black Democrats were just trying to keep African Americans, quote, on the plantation. Second worst in the Nonsense Hall of Shame this week was Mitch McConnell filibustering his own bill in the Senate. That's right. You heard me right. He filibustered his own bill. Andrew Rosenthal of the New York Times described the bizarre going-ons like this. In the morning of Thursday, December 6th, Mr. McConnell went to Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, and asked him to take a vote on a bill that would allow the president to raise the debt ceiling. You know, the debt ceiling is the artificial limit imposed by Congress on how much the government may borrow to make good on past debt. Now, Mr. McConnell's clever plan, and clever should be in quotes there, was that Democrats would not be able to muster a regular majority to pass the bill, thus proving to the world that the Democrats don't really want to end the pointless fight over the debt ceiling that Mr. McConnell himself cooked up in 2011. But Mr. Reid consulted with his caucus and found support for the bill. So he went to the floor, offered it, and scheduled 20 minutes of debate before an up or down vote. And that's when Mr. McConnell may have made Senate history. He rose in objection to his own bill. quote, matters of this level of controversy always require 60 votes, he said. He added that he wanted my friend, the majority leader, to make it 60 votes, end quote. Mr. Reid said no and announced that the Republican leader objects to his own idea. We have a filibuster of his own bill. Senator Durbin, the minority whip, indicated that he would have the Senate parliamentarian research to find out if this has ever happened before. This is historical levels of partisan craziness and historical levels of nonsense. But we really shouldn't expect anything more from Senator McConnell. After all, he is the one who, after President Obama was initially sworn in, said that his and his party's main priority wasn't the economy, which was in free fall. It wasn't the wars or any other issue. It was making President Obama a one-term president. What's even more scary is that this was not the worst nonsense this week. What was the worst nonsense of the week was said at a panel to discuss the legacy and future of the Clean Air Act. The panel was convened by National Journal and the American Lung Association, and it was Republican Representative Joe Burton from Texas who made some completely nonsensical claims. As reported by Think Progress, Congressman Burton claimed that carbon dioxide is not only irrelevant to the Clean Air Act, but that it's not dangerous at all because it is, quote, a necessity for life, end quote. To illustrate his example, he noted that he was exhaling carbon dioxide as he spoke and actually argued that people create greenhouse gases because they create life, so greenhouse gases are good. There's a reason that you build things called greenhouses, he said, and that's to help things grow. Barton also claimed that the atmosphere had, in the past, contained carbon dioxide levels greater than 5,000 parts per million, implying that we could do so again today. The current scientific consensus, however, is that 350 parts per million is the safe upper limit. Barton said that he accepted that the climate is changing, but he discounted human opinion, human influence and the rise in extreme weather as opinions. Let me further paint a picture for you on this, okay? You have an entire conference of folks at a large center with a main ballroom and breakout rooms. Almost all of the people attending are senior scientists and researchers and people reporting on the sciences concerning the environment their whole lives. And you have two or three congressmen, including Joe Barton, who is supposed to be so educated about energy that the Republicans and John Boehner made him the chairman of the House Energy Committee. At a panel discussion between himself and just one other person on stage in the main ballroom in this conference full of scientists, Barton says, quote, greenhouse gases are good. There's a reason that you build things called greenhouses, and that's to help things grow, end quote. Needless to say, virtually everyone who spoke after him pointed out how ridiculous his claim was. Dr. Jerome Paulson of the Children's National Medical Center pointed out the silliness of Barton's argument that CO2 is a necessity for life. Paulson noted, if we had no sodium, we wouldn't be alive. But there does come a point where people consume too much sodium, or if there's too much sodium in their bodies, that it becomes toxic and people can die. The same is true, Paulson said, of CO2 in the atmosphere. It's necessary, but too much of it is clearly a bad thing. This more than Hall of Shame-worthy nonsense is viewable on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. The video of the panel discussion is online there at my blog, and the part with Congressman Barton starts at about the 39th minute of that video. There's nothing like making one of the most ignorant statements imaginable about a particular science on stage in a large conference hall filled with experts about that science. That's our GOP. Way to go, Congressman Barton. That's all I have for this afternoon. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time this Sunday, December 16th. Until then, have a great rest of your afternoon and a great week.